Call the meeting to order. Good morning. This is State Government Finance Committee meeting for Thursday, February 17th, 2011. You have before you the minutes of our meeting from yesterday. Would someone move those minutes?
So moved.
Moved by Murray. Any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. Well, members, we're off to the races today to start with here. So first of all, we want to call forward Mr. Richard Krueger, Executive Director of the Racing Commission. Welcome, Mr. Krueger, and please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Dick Krueger, the Executive Director of the Racing Commission. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to give an overview of the activities and responsibilities of the Racing Commission and its staff. And as I'm going through that description, I'll touch on some of the numbers, if that's okay with the chair.
Okay. Steve.
The commission itself is made up of nine members appointed by the governor with Senate confirmation. They're appointed for six-year staggered terms, so every other year, three commissioners are up for reappointment. We'll have three vacancies coming up at the end of June of this year. The primary responsibilities of the commission that are set by statute are to issue and renew Class A, B, C, and D licenses, and I'll go into those briefly in a moment. They assign race days, live race days, and televised days. They have fairly broad rulemaking authority. They approve parimutuel pools and racing officials, oversight of our equine drug testing program, and they review appeals of stewards' rulings regarding any disciplinary matters that might occur at the racetrack. And they have the responsibility of approving plans of operation for the operation of the card clubs at the racetracks. The Class A license, which is stipulated in statute, is the license that's issued for the ownership of a parimutuel racetrack in the state. And that license fee is set by statute. It's $253,000 a year. The Class B license, which is in statute, is the license to actually run a parimutuel race meet. And the legislature has set staggered fees for that. It's $500 for every live racing day and $100 for every televised racing day. Those are days on which they take simulcasts from other racetracks around the country. The legislature has set stipulations for what's called Class C licensees, which are occupational licenses that we issue to all the folks that work, own horses, work for the racetrack, work on the backside, where we license jockeys, trainers, horse owners, the employees of Canterbury Park and Running Aces. We also license the board of directors of those two corporations. And those fees are set by rule of the Racing Commission. Now, those fees that I've just described are the basis of the appropriation that the legislature makes to the Racing Commission. And on page 2 of the handout, you can see what our history has been in the collection of those fees. The legislature also set a Class D license, which is the parimutuel license for a county fair that may want to race parimutually. We've only had one of those in the state, and that was the Traverse County Fair that held their county fair in Wheaton from 94 through 2001. The staff of the commission, we have 12.7 FTEs. Of those 12.7, 10 are full-time year-round employees. We do add seasonal employees during the summer, Drain Live Racing, and those are the administrators for the vet's office and our lead test barn technicians. Our appropriation for the last biennium was $899,000, but the governor and the legislature reduced the first year by $19,000 and the second year by $29,000, the year we're in now. So we had $870,000 that was appropriated to us for this year. But that was a one-time, by rider in that appropriation, that was a one-time reduction. So we did go back in our base to the $899,000. And that's the number that has been recommended by the governor. Page 5, Mr. Chairman, of the handout shows the history of the betting handle at Canterbury Park going back to 1985, first year that Canterbury opened. And you can see that after 2004, the handle has gradually been declining, both in live and simulcasting. And it's the live handle that generates the revenue for both the racetracks, and off of that handle, they make all of their operational expenses, their payroll. They also have to set aside certain amounts for purses. So consequently, their revenue has declined, and the purses have declined. And it's the level of purses that drive the investment by your horse owners across the state, as far as the investment they want to make in racehorses, have the opportunity to get a return on that investment. Our primary staff duties are the stewards and the veterinarians. By statute, there must be three stewards at each racetrack. They are 100% reimbursed to us by the racetracks. That's under 240-155. That's a statutory appropriation that we do have authority for. And the stewards act, they have two primary duties. They act as the referees of the actual racing event, either in the afternoons, on the weekends, or in the evenings, on Thursdays and Fridays. And if something happens during the running of the race, they have the video technology to review any incident, talk to the jockeys in the winner's circle to make a determination as to what might have happened during the running of a race as far as interference or anything else that might have happened. And then they also have judicial powers that the legislature has given them, whereby they hold hearings regarding alleged violations of the racing rules, and they can issue a findings of fact, of conclusions, and an order, which we call a ruling, regarding any violation. And the legislature has given them authority to suspend licensees up to 90 days and to fine them up to $2,000. And as I mentioned earlier, they do have the right to appeal that, which then is reviewed by at least three members of the Racing Commission who hear the evidence again and issue their own findings of fact, conclusions, and an order. The program that's most vital to the horse is our veterinary program. We have regulatory vets at both racetracks. They maintain a medical record for every horse that enters the grounds. Last year we maintained almost 2,000 records for horses that were brought onto the grounds at either Canterbury Park or Running Aces. They do conduct pre-race exams on all horses that are racing every day. Last year, they conducted almost 8,200 pre-race exams at both racetracks, Canterbury Park and Running Aces. And again, under 240-155, we are reimbursed for our costs of the veterinarians. Our medical testing program is administered by industrial laboratories outside of Denver, Colorado. At least two horses from each race are tested, whereby we take custody of the horse in the winner's circle, accompany that horse down to the test barn, where we collect urine and blood, which is then sent to our drug testing laboratory. And usually within 4 or 5 days, we get the results of those tests. And again, those costs are reimbursed to us by the racetracks. Under 240 Minnesota Statutes, Chapter 240.18, the Racing Commission administers the Breeders' Fund Program. It was established by the legislature back in 1983 when they passed the enabling legislation. There's a 1% tax on the handle, which is paid to the Racing Commission, whereby we then redistribute that money back to the Minnesota owners and breeders of horses that have been bred in Minnesota in the form of purse supplements, breeders' awards, and stallion awards. And they are those numbers are based upon how the horses that they've had at the track racing compared to the total purses that were run, and we distribute the Breeders' Fund money back to the Minnesota owners and breeders. Now, to participate in that program, you have to have the horse registered with the Racing Commission by January 31st, except for thoroughbred mares, which is May 15th, which means the horse has to be in the state and has to foal in the state of Minnesota. And I always characterize this as the legislature's way to, at that time, to stimulate the rural agribusiness community, whereby you have horses that are out on the farm consuming hay and feed and veterinary services and insurance services and things of the like. And you can, that our registration information is on page 6 of the handout, and you can see that as the handle has declined, so have the number of mares and foals and stallions declined over the years. So we do have fewer Minnesota owners and breeders than we had 20 years ago. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, in 1999, the legislature passed card club legislation authorizing Class A licensees to operate card clubs. And Canterbury opened their card club in 2000 after they had raced their 50 days. And the purpose of their legislation, it's in statute, and I'll quote it. It is the intent of the legislature that the proceeds of the card playing activities authorized by this chapter be used to improve the horse racing industry by improving purses. That happened immediately after for the 2001 race meet. The card club legislation has matched the purse money that is earned by Canterbury off simulcasting and live racing, so it actually doubled their purse structure, and at Running Aces, it accounts for about 80% of their purse structure. Neither card club opened until the commission had reviewed a very detailed and comprehensive plan of operation, and reviews any amendments to that plan of operation, which includes internal controls, security, and surveillance. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my remarks, and I'll be more than happy to answer any questions that any members of the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Krueger, and members. this will be not only a session to hear about the work of the commission, but also our budget review. And this won't come back up again until we have our omnibus bill before us. And so we need to particularly focus here today on the budget and making sure we understand the budget, what the governor has proposed. And members, the governor's budget pages are in your packet. So please, if you haven't already pulled it out, pull it out for the Racing Commission. Mr. Krueger, a question that I would like to ask is, if you look on page 2 of your slides, it shows that the special revenue for the last 2 years at $794,000 $5,000. And if you take a look on page 6 of the Racing Commission Governor's budget, it shows special revenue at $11,126,000. Can you reconcile those numbers for me? Obviously, that includes something that's not on your page 2 of your slides.
You're looking at the miscellaneous special revenue.
Yes.
$1,126,000 versus our $794,000. I'll have to get you a I'll have to get a reconciliation back to your staff on that.
Okay.
I'll have to look at the detail of the revenue reports that I have.
And does the $1,126,000 does that represent, in effect, all other revenues that come in addition to the general fund budget of $870,000 as it's been?
The $870,000 is the license fees that I discussed. The license fees we're estimating do not get up to the $899 of our base level, because we've got the money that comes in goes into a control account, and if we don't spend it, it rolls forward to the next biennium. So we've planned to get back to the base to use part of that roll forward if we indeed spend $899,000. Now, if you look at 2010, it's on page 8 of the governor's budget, you'll see that the appropriation was $880,000. It was reduced by $19,000 for that year, but we only spent $730,000. So we didn't spend up to the base level budget.
Ms. Roberts, could you help us with this discussion?
Mr. Chair, when you're looking at page 6, and looking at the special revenue numbers, the first number, the $899,000, that's the governor's recommendation.
Yeah.
That is special revenue fund that is directly appropriated in the omnibus bill. As Mr. Kruger said, the funds are deposited in an account, but are not, the commission does not have statutory authority to spend all of the revenues that come in. This committee will make a determination to directly appropriate that amount, and that's the amount that comes from the license fees. Right. The other special revenue funds below are the other fees of the Breeders' Fund and other miscellaneous fees that are statutorily appropriated to the commission.
That's correct. Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
The $1.1 million is the amount that I referred to as being reimbursed to us by the racetracks for stewards, veterinarians, our drug testing lab, and our oversight of the card clubs, which includes personnel costs. That's the $1.126 million. The other figure was what Ms. Roberts was referring to, is the collection of license fees, which supports the appropriation that the legislature makes to us.
Okay. Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kruger, you mentioned actually two parts of my question to help me get a big picture view. You got 12.7 employees.
Correct.
Could you tell me, is there a page that shows me what those positions are? If you could refer me to that, or maybe just give me an overview. And then you've got a very short season here in Minnesota relative to other parts of the country. What happens, I mean, probably 60% of the year there's no racing. What do you do in your organization? What do you lay off people, or how does that work?
No.
Mr. Kruger?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the 10 full-time people include myself, Deputy Executive Director Mary Manny, who is officed up at Running Aces. We have a coordinator for licensing and paramutual auditing. although light and licensing is heavy in April and May at both racetracks when people are coming in, but the both racetracks operate year-round for simulcasting and a card club. So there's parimutuel auditing going on every day with regard to the simulcasting that the patrons at Canterbury Running Aces are betting on other racetracks around the country. We have an office manager and a Breeders' Fund coordinator who is full-time. We have an IT project manager, two licensing assistants, one at Canterbury, one at Running Aces, and we have three investigators, the director of security and two investigators. Two of them are at Canterbury, one of them is at Running Aces. That should equal 10.
Okay.
And then the other two, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, the other two, 2.7 are the seasonal people we bring in to assist the veterinarians during the summer.
Representative Stensrud?
And just one follow-up then. Is there a lot of investigation that goes on off-season? It's kind of a year-round thing, or because you said those are full-time investigators, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it all depends on what might be going on up on the floors of the card clubs or simulcasting. You know, I prefer that we not have to do any investigations, but there are times when we need to respond to a certain situation or an incident that that may have taken place. They're not frequent. They're very infrequent. But when they happen, I want to respond if there's a violation of rule or statute.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Krueger? Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Krueger, I'm reading the fourth page of the agency profile, which has a description, I think, of the racing industry generally under your budget trends. And quotes Running Aces as, you know, having kind of had to fight a national trend that's been working against the racing industry generally. I guess the question really is, did we build into a recession in this industry, and what do you see as the future there? Or is this something where we might just have to go back and look and say, gosh, maybe that just wasn't so good, and maybe we need to cut our losses?
Mr. Krueger?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you know, I'll be candid. Several years ago, I thought that gambling was immune from any recessionary events, but that's proven not to be the case. There is a lot of competition to parimutuel horse racing. You know, thus the legislature 10, 11 years ago went with a card club. You know, poker was a craze, but as the page 5 of the handout shows, that handle at Canterbury has been declining for the last 7 years. All of our estimates are based on straight line, hoping it's not going to go any lower, but I don't have a 24-month crystal ball as to what might actually happen.
Representative Banyan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Krueger, I feel for you, and I feel bad about this because this was back in the 80s when I first moved to Minnesota. Canterbury was brought on with great fanfare, and it was going to be the establishment of a horse industry, a horse raising industry, husbandry here in the state that was going to really do great things for the state. I knew people who were in the horse husbandry business, and they were very excited. And I look at your numbers now in terms of births of, you know, and the number of mares and foals you have, and say to myself, this looks like a really dying industry in the state. Aside from the gambling, what's going on with the horse industry in Minnesota?
Mr. Krueger?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if I can refer you again to the handout on page 6. If you look at the back in the late 80s through 1990, you see the exuberance there in the in the initial excitement about Paramutual. You see, in 1989, we registered over 1,300 thoroughbred brood mares in the state. And those were horses that were in the state on the farm and foaling out in Minnesota, whereas now we're down to 212 that were here last year. And that has been going down each year for the last 10 years. So, you know, Representative, I can't predict. We'll never get back up to those figures under the current environment. We'll never get back up to those figures in the late 80s. It'd be nice to see that again. As a regulator, I would like to see that again. But I don't see things changing right now.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The 1% tax on the handle, I've got a couple of questions actually. Sure. Along these lines. When was that instituted?
Mr. Krueger?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidiger, that was in the enabling legislation back in 1983.
Okay.
That hasn't changed.
And, of course,
Representative Leidiger,
the idea behind that is, you know, give incentive for local breeding, help the whole husbandry program, and hasn't been changed, it seems like, in, like you say, 20-some years.
That's correct. We're estimating that to be about $1.1 million that we're going to distribute back to the Minnesota horsemen and women that have horses at Canterbury or running aces. And it goes back in the form of purse supplements for the race, breeders' awards, or stallion awards.
Does the entire amount get paid out then each year?
It all gets paid out, with the exception of about $28,000 that we keep to administer the program. So out of a million-dollar program, you know, we're spending about $28,000. Pam Weber in our office is our Breeders' Fund coordinator. But the rest of it then all goes back to the constituents in your district that have horses.
Representative Leidiger. But
what I'm driving at is that the only incentive that we have for the local breeders? Is there, along the same lines as Representative Banyan, I mean, I'm very concerned about the industry. Do you have other ideas that we could use to incentivize the whole program?
Mr. Krueger.
Mr. Chairman, you could perhaps change the law and have that 1.5% tax on the handle or 2% tax on the handle. Something else I was going to say, and I can't remember what it was right now, but it'll come back to me. That's just the Breeders' Fund. I mean, if a Minnesota bred horse wins a race, they get the purse. Say it's a $10,000 purse, they'll get $6,000. They get 60% of the purse. But then they also get a purse supplement because it's a Minnesota-bred horse.
Right. This is just a supplement.
This supplements the purse that was offered for that race. So it's not just this, but it's also the 8.4% of the handle that's set aside for purses. Have I answered your question?
Yes, you have. I'm looking for more answers that really aren't there, and that is, how do you stimulate this industry? And I'm not, that's the question. It's an open-ended question.
Yep. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's kind of following up with Representative Leidiger, you know, looking at, you know, what can be done to incentivize. It seems like various things have been tried over the years. You know, the card club improves things for a while, and then, you know, other incentives, but it, you know, the decline has continued. Is this mostly based on the economy, would you think?
Mr. Krueger?
It's part of it, Mr. Chairman. It is part of it. It's also competition from other forms of gambling. It's also internet gambling, which is illegal. You got people betting on horse races around the country from their parlors in their homes, or playing poker. So it's more than just one impact on the racetracks.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kruger, you know, the last figures that I saw, and they could be not as accurate today, was that Minnesota was number 3 in the nation per capita on gambling, with, I think, Las Vegas and Atlantic City 1 and 2. I don't know if it's so important that that's the exact place where we are today, but, I mean, we do have a fairly high percentage in Minnesota of per capita gambling. Have we reached a saturation level, do you think?
Mr. Kruger?
You know, Mr. Chairman, some of these questions probably should be directed at the lottery because they've got a better handle on some of it. I'm not going to dodge the question, Representative. There are people that know more about that than I do. You know, I'm trying to focus on pari-mutuel horse racing and card playing. Apologize if I can't answer your question, sir.
Okay.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kruger, maybe I'll ask that question again when the lottery folks come up. But I'll just throw the word out there. What do you think the impact of Racino would be?
Mr. Kruger.
Mr. Chairman, you know, the racetracks obviously are revenue challenged right now. They have been for Canterbury for the last 8 years. Running Aces is going to run its fourth race meet this summer, but they're revenue challenged. Canterbury has made their best efforts to have promotions, use a facility for other events at the racetrack. A Racino would help. There's no doubt about it.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the only thing you could do to revitalize the horse breeding industry is to repeal common sense. I actually have kids who are in this business, not this level horse, but in Oregon, and the I'll tell you, the recession has hit the buying of recreational horses far more than homes or anything else. And they haven't bred a foal or done anything like that for, you know, multiple years. And it's, believe me, you get rid of a horse as a pet a lot faster than you get rid of a dog or a canary.
I think it costs a little bit more, doesn't it?
As a person who pays the dental bills and things like that for grandkids, I assure you it does.
The kids or the horses?
The kids. I think it's all related, though. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Kruger, thank you very much for being here today and for providing that information. Final word?
One other thing, Mr. Chairman, I would like to work with staff and set up a couple of days this summer that we can get as many members of the committee out there as possible to take a look at what we do during the course of a live race day. So I'll work with your staff to set up a number of days when we can get some folks out there. Bring your family. It's a tour. It's a tour that you won't forget.
Well, thank you, and we would look forward to that invitation. So thank you, Mr. Kruger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Our next presenter is Mr. Tom Barrett, the Executive Director of the Gambling Control Board. Welcome, Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Pleasure to be here. My name is Tom Barrett. I'm the Director of the Gambling Control Board. And if it's all right, similar, I'll give a brief overview background of who we are, what we do, how we do it. Get into some of the budget numbers, some statistics that I think you'll find interesting, and then focus briefly on some of the issues that you all might be hearing as the session wears on. So if that's all right to proceed.
You may proceed.
Thank you. As the Gambling Control Board, our mission is twofold. One, it's obviously to regulate and maintain the integrity of the operations, the game, so the players that are participating are assured it's of proper standards. And then also for the nonprofit organizations that are involved in the conduct of charitable gambling, that the proceeds get to where they should be intended to. Pretty simple. By definition or by description, Gambling Control Board a lot of times will get calls involving lottery scratch games or slot machines at casinos. Obviously, we don't have any oversight of lottery, tribal gaming. We work closely with our counterparts, public safety, on the internet and the illegal gambling. And obviously, the horse racing stands on their own. But oftentimes, we'll get calls. But we work very close together in terms of if there's issues that are happening in the industry to refer some of the complaints or allegations, what have you. But our focus is on charitable gambling. What is charitable gambling? There's five forms of charitable gambling right now. Pull tabs, which I think you're pretty familiar with. That's the bread and butter of the industry, representing roughly 91% of the gross receipts. We have something called tip boards. Now, we just had the Super Bowl last week. Did anybody have numbers on the game? Good answer. No, because that'd be the illegal tip board. But there is a...
Is that called public self-incrimination?
It was a very good answer, Mr. Chair, so I appreciate that. But there is a legal form of tip board, but it makes up a very small, less than 1% of the gross receipts in charitable gaming. There's something called a paddle wheel. That's not to be confused with a riverboat, okay? It's like the Wheel of Fortune or the small meat raffles at local bars. Roughly 1.5% of the gross receipts. Bingo. Been around since early times. Actually first recognized in Minnesota back in 1945. But it's actually an old form of a game, but it's on the rise in terms of activity and the way bar owners are looking to bring additional clients into their places, work with the charity. So that represents approximately 6% of the receipts. And then there's raffles. Probably anybody in this room has participated in some form of a raffle. But again, that makes up less than 1% of the total gross receipts. Who regulates charitable gambling? We have a 7-member citizens board. 5 are appointed by the governor, 1 is appointed by the commissioner of public safety, and 1 is appointed by the attorney general. That board is supported by 28.1 full-time equivalent positions, and I'm happy to state that 86% of those staff, those 28 people, are hands-on regulatory in terms of doing the compliance audits, doing the licensing, or doing the investigations. The administrative part shifts down to 4 people. How do we regulate? Anybody that's involved in the conduct of lawful gambling, handling the product, is licensed. They go through background checks. They'll go through the audits, but we license all the nonprofits. Each nonprofit that's licensed is required to have a member of that organization be licensed as the gambling manager. The manufacturers that make the product, the distributors that deliver the product, all those are licensed. The primary officers of each of those entities go through a background check. We also provide education and training, primarily focusing on the gambling manager, the one that has the hands-on experience with the reporting. We approve and test all the games before you see it on the street. On average, it's upwards of 350 new games every month that the board is considering approving, and then we do the testing. Regulatory audits, site inspections, that's the real focus of our staffing, the compliance reviews, making sure that the sites are properly posting in terms of the rules, the conduct is being done, the reports are being filed, and the taxes are being paid. And if we need to get their attention, there is the opportunity to issue fines, suspensions, revocations. The industry that we're regulating, right now there's approximately 3,200 licensed gambling sites in Minnesota. We have approximately 1,300 licensed charitable organizations. Last year we issued over 3,200 exempt permits. Now, exempt permits are the relatively small activity when it comes to a church raffle or a fall festival, something like that. But the value of those exempt small activities amounted to over $31 million in gross receipts for those charities. Big numbers. There's also 13 distributors, 11 manufacturers, and then we have 1 Link Bingo provider that is also licensed. The industry numbers. Last year, gross receipts in charitable gambling were just under $1 billion. $1 billion. Minnesota is number 2 in the country when it comes to gross receipts for charitable gaming. The state collected approximately $36 million in charitable gambling taxes, and our regulatory budget, as you see in the packet, is approximately 2.7%. I did include one visual. it's typical where the people want to know, where does the money go? And so for the value, as the best way I could show it, the value of that $1 raffle or a pull tab ticket represented 100 pennies. At the bottom line, the cost to regulate this industry is approximately 3/10 of one of those pennies. We're number two in the country in terms of size and opportunity, one of the smallest when it comes to regulation. Now, where does money go in terms of the charity? For that $1 that's spent on a pull tab, approximately 82 of those pennies, 82% goes back to the player in the form of prizes. The state collects approximately, on average, 4% in taxes. The charity is allowed for paying the staff, buying the games, promoting approximately 10%. What gets down to the charitable bottom line is 4%. Some of the budget history since 2007, because there's been some significant changes in terms of activity with charitable gambling. Since fiscal year 2005, the industry has dropped over $400 million in gross receipts. Because of that and the fact that we're dedicated funded, we've taken steps, as you see in your budget books as well, to implement some of the cuts. So since fiscal year 2007, we've actually cut staffing by approximately 18%. We're dedicated funds. None of the funds that come to our gambling control board are from the general fund. But at the same time, we come before the committees here to receive the appropriation. There is a cap on what we can spend. So in anticipation of the anticipated decrease, once again, the budget proposal we're proposing and the governor supports is approximately 6.8% reduction. We've already implemented the cuts. We knew they were coming. But it's trying to maintain some level of regulatory oversight, but still maintain some recognition of what's happening in the industry. Now, to put it in perspective, some of the staffing ratios, currently we have what I would say one investigator for every 1,200 sites. And a good comparison, you know, if we use our folks over at the Department of Natural Resources, if you knew you were going to have one game warden for every 1,200 lakes, there's a chance you might keep that extra walleye or maybe not get a license. That's a concern of the regulatory, and it's a concern, obviously, of the industry. But at the same time, I think we've done a very good job in terms of the compliance audits and those kinds of reviews to keep that operation where it needs to be. It's not without problems. We'll find issues where, yes, there's illegal gambling going on. There was a recent case that was on the news a couple weeks ago. Unfortunately, we had a bartender that was playing, should have been playing, forging. And what happened is we stepped in, the charity got out of the site, so the charity lost the benefits, the proceeds there, but the bar continues to obviously operate. Those are one of the things that we want to work together possibly with public safety when it comes to the liquor license and those situations when there's some wrongdoing. In terms of audits, though, with our compliance staff, we have one compliance specialist for approximately every 90 organizations. So we're on an audit cycle roughly once every 2 years. It's going to creep up a little with the anticipated cut. But at the same time, the charities welcome us out there doing the audit. They want to know that what they're doing is the right way they're doing it. We have live body. Anybody has a question or problems, they can call us at any time during the regular business hour, office hours. But our point is to, if there's an issue, if there's a problem or a question, we want to be able to get back to the charity. There's consultants, accountants out there that can certainly help. But we really want to focus on trying to help the charity maintain. We got 29% of the licensed organizations are veterans. And as we all know, the veteran organizations are aging. It's tough to get people to volunteer, participate. But those, the proceeds of what the veterans use, instrumental in terms of maintaining their posts. Some of the good things that have happened in the past year. We instituted what we call perpetual licensing. This was back when there was a focus to reduce the local mandates. And so we offered up a suggestion, because every 2 years, a charity would come up for a license renewal. And every 2 years, the charity would go first to the local unit of government, get the approval, and then come back to us, and then we'd reload all the forms and all licensing. Rarely, in fact, my tenure, I never saw once a charity was approved, the local unit of government ever deny the permit renewal. So he said, hey, maybe there's an opportunity to save. And so once the local unit of government approves the license and they come in and they're approved by the board, then it becomes perpetual. We're not sending the license renewals back out. We're sending the invoice for the annual fees, but it's a tremendous saving in terms of that process and that paperwork. Now, we heard back from the cities going, wait a minute, we're missing the opportunity to talk to the charities. No, they're not, and that's where we're working with the League of Minnesota Cities to say, you have the opportunity to call them back anytime to your city council, your county board, if you have questions. But I think it's been an example of working effectively with local units of government, reducing the paperwork, and moving on. We also instituted what we call a star rating. Now, this report wasn't provided, but I'm certainly happy to get it to you. We wanted to bring focus back to what charitable gambling is all about, where the charities are spending their money. Obviously, there's some focus on the taxes. There's a recent article in the Minneapolis paper, you know, how little is getting to charitable. And yet there is an allowance for the taxes they paid and those things. So we said, we're going to put in what we call a star rating. It's based on a percentage of their net receipts, and it's pretty much a minimum 30% needs to get to charitable purposes, lawful purposes, including taxes. If they're below that mark, if they fall below the three-star rating, 30%, then they show up automatically on our radar. So they're mindful of where they need to be the following year. That's proven very helpful. We also took the opportunity to revise the rules in light of some of the law changes, and we simplified those. And then we also finished up implementing the recommendations when we did a study back in 2009 on issues affecting the industry. And for the most part, the majority of those recommendations that came back to legislature that were approved have all been implemented. Some of the things that didn't get implemented, tax reform, that's probably an issue you'll hear later on, and a couple other things. But if I can, maybe just some of the issues, I think, in anticipation of some questions, some things you might hear coming up. I know the industry is mindful, concerned about the lack of automation when it comes to their games. We just heard the Racing Commission and their opportunity to compete. Now, we stay regulatory neutral, but at the same time, we've done a lot of effort in terms of research, what could happen, what could be allowed, and how would we be ready to respond in terms of regulatory approach. But there's a number of factors affecting charitable gambling, and the primary concern is the automation. Now, we look at a regulatory and say, opportunity to automate these games. We see an opportunity in terms of inventory control and tracking. Right now, it's all paper. We work very close with the Department of Revenue on the inventory tracking as it relates to the tax obligation. But that is an opportunity in terms of regulation. We see opportunity to improve. Every year we hear about sports boards. Okay, still illegal, but a lot of people think it's a state law. It's not a state law. It's a federal law that prohibits the wagering based on the outcome of a sporting event. But at the federal level, there's consideration to easing maybe some of the restrictions, be it internet as well as sports wagering. When we look at the law that was passed in the federal side, at that time there's four states that were doing sports wagering. Nevada, obviously, Delaware, Oregon, and Montana. Those are the only four states that can legally wager based on the outcome of a sporting event. But then we look to our neighbors in North Dakota. They've been doing something called sports pools for a number of years. And talking to them, it's like, how can you do it and the others can't? And that's one of those things that we're exploring a little more as far as why can they do it, we can't. I know the industry would love to see the law passed so it can be challenged. But if there's any concern, because I know it comes up every year, happy to provide some insight in that respect. But you might hear about that coming up as well. Aging charities, I talked briefly about the veterans. But that is a concern in terms of those posts, those locations serving as kind of community gatherings and the use of gambling proceeds for whether it's the 4th of July Veterans Memorial, those kinds of things. We're starting to see an impact because the local units of government are going, who's going to help us with our civic festival if the veterans post doesn't have enough funds from their charitable gaming? Fire relief, another significant beneficiary in terms of the use of gambling proceeds, the fire safety equipment, those things. We're also unfortunately seeing the increase, the rise of theft and fraud. Might be a sign of the times, but the board's going to be looking at trying to take some precautionary steps to minimize the exposure when it comes to cash. It's a $1 billion industry, and it's pretty much all cash out there. Taxes, we remain neutral. The one offer we do point out that if there's an opportunity to look at reform, it's the board's position that whatever we could do to simplify it. We have five forms of charitable gambling, and there's four different tax rates based on which game you're playing or how well you're playing. So that's a concern of the industry as well. And then again, local review. Very happy that we were able to work with the city, work with the legislature to get the perpetual licensing system in place. And it's proven, I think, to be a very cost-saving opportunity and one that works quite well for the industry we're regulating. So with that brief overview, Mr. Chair, I would certainly stand for questions and get into the detail of the budget.
We have a number of members who have questions or comments. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that we have is the any city can put a 10% tax on that. How many cities have done that, and are there any big cities that haven't done it?
Mr. Barrett.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, what you're talking about is it has to be passed first by a local ordinance. So the local unit of government would have to say, for any charitable gambling taking place within our city confines, we can require up to 10%, not all of them take the full 10%, of proceeds, and that goes into a fund administered by the city, and then they use it for park maintenance and the like. That's on the rise in terms of, I think it might be a case, maybe not all local units of government know that opportunity is there. But at the same time, we see charities that willingly donate to the local unit of government without being forced to donate. But what I don't think we have in their annual report, and I think that copy was provided too, but I'll get it, but there's a detailed report that shows, here it is, on page 12 of the report, excuse me, not last year's. I'm sorry, on page 10 of the previous year. In that little box, local units of government reported $6.6 million in local contributions under that 10% allowance. What I would offer is if you want a detailed list of all those local cities that took advantage of that, I can get you that separate.
Yes, I would like that.
Representative Erdahl.
It's 90, Mr. Chairman, I'm actually not finished. So that's 97 cities required that. So if we're looking at local government aid going down, it certainly seems as if there's a lot of room to local units of government to increase that as opposed to increasing property taxes. And then I have a comment on the sports bookmaking, of which I don't think I've put the bill in yet, but I still have it. Many years ago, in fact, when Humphrey was Attorney General, we had a report done on what I wanted the state to do was to sue the federal government, saying that it was unfair that we had these four states and Minnesota was not among them. You can get that report. I probably have a copy of it somewhere. You can also get it from the Legislative Reference Library. But the answer at that time was that we didn't have standing to sue unless somebody was stopping us. And so what we had to do if we wanted to get into this market, which is now my associates aren't really big gamblers, but the one thing tons of people I know do is sports bookmaking, illegal as it is. And so if we want to get this federal law changed, we have to pass a sports bookmaking. We have to set it up, and then someone has to sue us to stop it, and then that will get into the courts at that time. It is the one issue I believe that the tribes are on our side. They could see that they could really profit with the setups that they have with legal sports bookmaking. So, you know, again, I think it's an easy pull of money out there, so I'm willing to advance it if anyone's willing to help.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been on a board that had charitable gambling pull tabs, the Litchfield Baseball Association, and we were starting to lose money at it. and so had to stop doing that. You said that I think there were $400 million less in receipts. How many fewer permits is that? How many less gambling sites are there?
Yep. Mr. Barrett.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verdahl, surprisingly, when a charity gets out, they're giving up a site, and then often we see another charity might go into that site. And there could be a couple of reasons in terms of losing money. I mean, obviously, these games are not set up to lose money, but depending upon how the operation goes, if the big winners go out, so to speak, those are some of the concerns, those are some of the things we're looking at. But when we look at the drop in organizations, we've lost approximately 200 organizations in the last couple of years. The number of sites haven't dropped at the same rate, though, because normally we'll see another charity slide into that spot.
Mm. Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, I would imagine that the economy has a lot to do with this. We have legions now, you know, closing here and there as well. The Post closing down, and I think in part because their charitable gambling isn't doing what it did before. But separate from the economy, if there's one thing that you would suggest could be done in Minnesota to bring it the level back up, what would that be?
Mr. Barrett?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I appreciate the opportunity again. As regulatory, we try to stay neutral, but again, we're mindful of the industry we're regulating. We talk about the economy, and yet you'll hear, I think, following me, the lottery had a record year. Now, in terms of an industry that's selling similar products, the fact that the charitable went down $400 million since 2005 and the lottery had a good year, there's a number of different comparisons. It's a little bit with apples and oranges, so don't get me wrong, with all due respect to our counterparts at the lottery. But I know they had some interesting games. They'll talk about, we all heard about the million-dollar raffle. That was around the holiday time, and Progressive Bingo. Those are opportunities, I think, in terms of, you know, bingo's been around, I said, since World War II, but it's all in the paper format. And that's where I think you're starting to hear more in terms of if there's an opportunity for the industry, charitable gaming industry, to get up to where maybe some of the other folks in this industry, this field of gambling are, would give them some opportunity. I mean, is it attracting the younger player, those things? I think, you know, if anybody has a dial tone or a dial telephone anymore, I'd be surprised. But its technology is changing. The fact that the games that are currently in play that we're regulating and improving every month are the same as they were in 85 is what I think some of the key focus is. But in terms of the economy, that's affected it. I think the fact that the primary locations for charitable gambling are bars, and that there's .08 and some of those things, those are other factors. Smoking ban took, a big impact. You could see when the smoking ban was implemented, the significant drop. The expectation, they'll come back. It hasn't come back, certainly in the numbers back then. But I think at the same time, the bars know, you know, repealing the smoking ban probably isn't going to happen. It's here to stay. So they're dealing with what's next. I mentioned briefly the bar bingo. This is something back when it was first considered. It was actually a border issue between Minnesota and North Dakota, where they had folks crossing the border from Minnesota to go over to Fargo to play noon hour bingo. We didn't allow that in Minnesota. Well, we worked with the legislators and said, well, we could certainly regulate it if we're going to call it that. As innocent as that was to start out with a noon-hour bingo opportunity, that transformed to what we call bar bingo, working with the charities, working with the bar owners to find a way, whether it's a happy hour or a special event, to bring people in, have them socialize, play a game. But it's proven to be very successful in terms of that type of operation, but still within the confines of kind of the existing paper Dob bingo. But it's an example that it actually showed an increase, not certainly to recoup what the industry has lost in terms of the other sales. But it's those things that we try hard to work with legislators as well as the industry. What can be done to help you, and then how can we regulate it?
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The 800-pound gorilla in this charitable gambling is pull tabs. 91% of the revenue comes in from pull tabs. I'd like to ask questions concerning costs of doing that business. I sat with the commander of the American Legion post. He actually grabbed me, sat me down, and said, and we went through the receipt. He said that nobody's making money on these pull tabs. He says the only people that are making money are the guys that are in the business, doing the production of the tabs and the and doing the distribution of it, et cetera, et cetera. He said, and you looked at it, there's like a $50 charge for every box, something like that. Maybe it was $46 a charge for a box. He says, and then he said, we make less than that amount. You know what? And I can't remember exactly what he said. The bottom line is, the costs of doing this business are enormous, and I don't see anywhere, and I've been trying to kind of find it, what the cost of that business is, the pull tabs business. Can you address that, please?
Mr. Barrett?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative, the best on the pie chart where we look at the cost of the organization, and it's roughly 10% of that $1, 100%. That includes the cost of the game. That includes...
Where is that pie chart, please? Which one?
In our annual...
I only have
maybe
one.
I don't have page. It in there.
It's not that. Well, the page 5 shows the where the 91% of the overall activity is pull tab. It doesn't talk about the breakout and the costs of doing that business.
Well, on page 8, where we have the detail, that's where it gets into what the operational costs for the total industry has reported. But knowing the numbers in comparison to that total pie chart, their operational costs, on average, are about 10%. Now, in terms of, what does it come off in the game, Minnesota is very competitive when it comes to the purchase price of that box of pull tabs and being the gorilla. $45-$50 bucks, pretty much the average cost. It's like about almost around a penny a ticket for the production cost of those. But what I think, and jumping in, not familiar with the Legion post, but one of the issues of concern by the industry involves the tax structure. Now, if it's a very successful operation and the receipts are up, because of that fact, it'll put higher organizations into what we call a combined receipts tax, and they pay a much higher percent of their net receipts to taxes, so there's less going to charity. We've heard from the industry in terms of, geez, we're paying more in taxes than we are going to the charitable side. It is a disproportionate. You'll see some charities paying upwards of 25-30% of their net receipts in taxes and less than 5% going for the charitable. There's different smaller organizations do a better job in terms of the bottom line simply because of the reduced tax burden in that sense. But to try to finish, there are issues.
It's 10%. You're saying the cost is 10%. That's $100 million that we're paying out to make this thing run. And when I looked at that receipt, it looked, based on what was on that, it looked like the percentage was a lot higher. It looked like it was as we were going through the discussion, it looked as though the cost of doing this business was in the neighborhood of about 40%. When you included the transportation and the cost, her having to go pick up I'm not sure exactly how they do that. You got to go pick it up from a central distribution point, the boxes. Can we get a breakdown of those costs? Can we of that whole business?
Mr. Barrett, can you provide that?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. And one of the things, in addition to the 10% report, but we do produce a report for every organization that shows gross receipts, prizes paid, expenses, taxes, charitable contributions. It's about a 33-page report, but you'll find it very interesting in terms of that level of detail. It's already been filed with the House Library and the Senate, but I'll specifically follow up and get a copy because it is interesting, and you will see a range of operational expenses based on what organization you're looking at.
Okay. Thank you.
We are about out of time. We need to move on to the next. Representative Benson and then Downey, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have to forgive me. I have someone in front of me I hope that can answer the question. It's probably one of these things where I could probably have my intern research a little bit more, but I'm going to take the time. I'm not a fan of gambling, but I know it's human nature, and you know, we've had some news stories passed around about where's the charity in charitable gambling, an article that was written in the Star Tribune. I find it kind of funny because it's a 3 or 4 page handout that we all received that at the bottom of it is an advertisement for Mystic Lake. And this is a serious note, however, and for me, I won't hide the fact that I don't approve of gambling. We're all here, you know, talking about how we can receive money off of, and there's another side to it, and that's my concern. I will tell you that as postmaster of Rochester, Minnesota, back in the 80s, we saw an exponential increase in the number of employees who were willing to steal from their till to pay gambling debts or to feed that habit. And I'll be honest with you, I plan to introduce a bill next session that sunsets all gambling, all forms of gambling in Minnesota. That's how strongly I feel about it. So, my question is, any of this money that we collect go to helping people with addiction, fighting addictions?
Mr. Barrett?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's a couple of opportunities I think are afforded for problem gambling. And one thing I failed to mention, included in our budget, we're kind of the stewards of a grant that originates out of proceeds from the lottery fund to fund the problem gambling awareness group. That's under our budget. We don't take any extra administrative costs. It's 100% passed on. Specifically related to charitable gambling, there is a code, an opportunity where charities can donate to problem gambling, compulsive gambling programs. Not a lot of use, but it's there. It's an opportunity for them to do that. To the extent of other gambling entities and what is afforded them, we work close with the Department of Human Services. Require that each site post the problem gambling sticker, call for help, those kinds of things. But in terms of the donations, there's an opportunity for any charity that's licensed to conduct gambling to donate directly to that program. The lottery, you'll probably hear about, has funds available for the problem gambling grant that normally passes through.
Just a short follow-up, Mr. Yep. Chair. I just one last question. Do you have any idea of a percent or an amount of funds that would come from just your area in regards to helping folks fight this disease?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, my guesstimate would be probably less than 1%. It's very small.
All right, thank you.
Representative Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm curious, you mentioned the opportunity, and I don't know exactly what that opportunity was, but to make electronic the current manual paper forms of these games and excluding any potential expansion on the sports gambling or some of the other things that have been discussed, if electronic means of today's existing gaming options were employed, what are the control, auditing, revenue benefits to exploring that? It seemed to me there were a few things you referenced, but I'm curious if you could go a little deeper on that question.
Mr. Barrett?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll try to be brief knowing the time, but the industry, we're aware of a couple of bills, three bills, I think, focusing on electronic bingo, electronic pull tab. There's video lottery that, in all honesty, wouldn't come under our purview. And a couple other things. But as relates to something that might be under our purview, electronic bingo, electronic pull tabs, what we're proposing in the research we've done and in prep, could it happen? We want to be as ready as we can. We see an opportunity regulatory-wise to improve reporting, inventory control. The fact that electronically these games purchased from a manufacturer to a distributor to the charity, we would be involved in that loop. We're not right now. We're very dependent on that distributor, and they're filing with revenue for tax purposes to track those games. So an instant opportunity for the regulators to see where those games are, how they're sold, how quick they're sold, and how they're closed out. That's an opportunity. In terms of the electronic bingo, electronic pull tabs expansion, what the industry is saying is we want to simply take the paper form and make it electronic. So some would argue there's not an expansion per se in the conduct. It's just the tool that's being used. Instead of a liquid dauber, it's an electronic dauber. But working with industry reps in terms of the manufacturing, something as simple as a handheld device this size that would be taken back to the bar table, like you would take the paper pull tabs, but it's played electronically. It's played on a radio frequency. The technology obviously is there. It's whether or not within the confines of the existing conduct of the games would it be allowed. The board is trying to be as ready to go, answer any questions, stay neutral. If it happens, we want to make sure the controls are there, that we still control, keep an eye on the games that are in play, how they're closed out, how they're reported, and ultimately, how does that money get to the bottom line of the charity? So there is opportunity in that sense. Do we have all the answers? There's a meeting tomorrow with some of the industry representatives on what's could happen in terms of that aspect.
Mr. Barrett, thank you for being here today, and we need to move on to our next subject. Next, the folks from the Minnesota State Lottery, Mr. Don Feeney and Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Dale McDonald. I'm the Assistant Director and General Counsel for the Lottery, and with me this morning is Don Feeney, the lottery's research and planning director. The lottery director, Clint Harris, is out of town and couldn't be here this morning. Mr. Feeney has a short presentation about the lottery, and then afterward we will be willing to respond to any questions that you may have regarding the lottery's operation and its budget.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Don Feeney. As Dale mentioned, I am the Research and Planning Director for the Minnesota State Lottery. At the moment, I am mostly relieved that the technology seems to have worked. This is not a computer you will be seeing on competing on Jeopardy anytime soon. The Minnesota State Lottery is, compared to the other agencies that you have heard from and will hear from, in many ways unique. I'm going to spend some time discussing our operations and then how the money flows to and from the lottery before getting into our budget specifics. And I recognize that there are a few of you for whom this is very old news, and I will apologize, but I think for the benefit of those of you who have not served on a committee that has dealt with us before, those of you who are new to the legislature, I think it's important in way of understanding how we operate. I know many of you know Mike Vekich, who was our acting director for several months in 2004. And after Mike had been working with the lottery for a while, he said one day, "You know, this is really a business in a government wrapper." And that's a completely accurate statement, and it reflects a reality that no citizen of Minnesota has to buy the product we make available, and no retailer has to sell them. We have to offer products that people want to buy, and we have to offer them in ways that our retailers want to sell them. But on top of that, Mike's statement also reflects a reality that we are a government agency, and with that comes a higher standard of accountability and a higher standard of responsibility that in transparency that in many ways is not expected of a private business. What we sell two basic types of products. We sell these through a network of about 3,000 retailers. Scratch games like Walleye Wealth that you see here account for close to 70% of our sales. We have to introduce about 55 new scratch games a year. Lotto games, of which Powerball is the best-known example, account for the remaining 30 to 35% of our sales, and of those, Powerball accounts for about 60% of it. Our governance. The lottery was authorized by voters in the 1998 election through a constitutional amendment. We are operated by a director who is appointed to the government by the governor with the advice and consent of the Senate, and who serves at the pleasure of the governor. And I mentioned earlier that we're different from other agencies, and one of the ways in which we are different from other agencies is that we do not receive an appropriation from the legislature. We show up on your budget spreadsheet only in terms of the revenue that we bring in, and in your appropriations bill as one line that sets a spending limit, basically the maximum amount of money that we can spend on internal operations. And what this reflects is a recognition by the legislature that we have to compete in a marketplace that requires that we have flexibility, requires that we have the ability to respond quickly when opportunities arise. We do need to strategically invest in order to keep up in this marketplace. We have to, as a business would tell you, often spend money to make money. Our expenditures, however, are audited regularly. We are required to have an independent outside audit every year, and the legislative auditor who audits with some degree of frequency. And our spending plans are readily available to the legislature, to the governor's office, to the to Minnesota Management and Budget. I should also mention that unlike the Racing Commission and the Lawful Gambling Board, we do not have a board. We did when we originally established. The legislature abolished that board in 1995. We have currently 143 staff. As recently as 2003, we were over 200. Our headquarters is in Roseville, with regional offices in Detroit Lakes, Marshall, Owatonna, and Virginia. Those offices serve as the home base for the staff who service those 3,000 retail stores around the state. In addition to marketing and sales, our staff are employed in areas such as security, accounting, warehouse and distribution, and information technology. And it probably will not be as memorable as a visit to the racetrack, but, Mr. Chairman, we certainly would invite the committee, either collectively or individually, to pay us a visit in Roseville and see how what is involved in operating this enterprise. We contribute to the state in several different ways. The first is net proceeds, which is what a business would call profits. It's basically what's left over after everything else is accounted for. And 40% of those proceeds go to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, and that dedication is mandated in the state constitution through the year 2024. The remainder of net proceeds it's up to the legislature to determine where those go, and currently all of it, 60%, goes to the general fund. There is also a 6.5% in lieu of sales tax on lottery tickets. By in lieu of, that means we collect it rather than the retailers, and essentially you're paying 93.5 cents for a dollar lottery ticket as opposed to $1.06 for a dollar lottery ticket. And that money is distributed by statute, as you see on the screen, 28% of it going to the general fund, 36% to the game and fish fund, and 36% to the natural resources fund. I emphasize that is in statute. Other than the dedication to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, this can be changed by the legislature at any time. Unclaimed prizes go to the general fund. Any prize that has not been claimed a year after it was won reverts to the state, and currently is directed to the general fund. A direct appropriation is made from the lottery prize fund to the compulsive gambling program. Currently that goes to the Department of Human Services to fund treatment and the state problem gambling helpline, and there is also a grant through that the Charitable Gambling Board administers to the state's affiliate on the National Council on Problem Gambling for public awareness and training programs. revenue recapture, we are required, anytime someone comes in with a prize that's $600 or more, we're required to check with the Department of Revenue to see if that person owes any debts to the state, and if they are, to withhold as much of that as we can from their prize. That winds up primarily being child support and back taxes. Last year, the revenue recapture was $186,000. It's not a tremendous amount of money. It's, however, when someone comes in owing money to, particularly to child support, it's kind of satisfying when that happens, although not always pleasant for the person having to tell them that. We have collected over $3 million from the lottery startup in 1990 through those means. And then when somebody comes in with claim of prize, we have to withhold income tax on that. That amount was $2.9 million in last fiscal year. That varies a lot from year to year. If we have a big jackpot winner, that amount will go up considerably. It's a nice windfall to have, and unfortunately it's one that we have not had for several years now. Our sales last year set a record at $499 million. You can see how it's come up significantly, although I would point out not nearly to the degree that sales of charitable gambling products by themselves are down. And if you add to that in decreases in racing revenue, you can and probably from anecdotally what I understand from the casinos, it's clear that that over the last few years, the total amount spent on gambling in Minnesota has gone down. Primarily, I believe, as a reflection of the economy. I think what we are seeing, to some degree, what we are seeing with lottery sales is a bit of a substitution effect. Instead of spending an evening at a casino or at the bar playing pull tabs or whatever, you buy a few scratch-off tickets, take that home, and that's your evening out. It's the same way, I think, that we're seeing people buying their coffee drinks at McDonald's or convenience stores as opposed to the $4 latte at the gourmet coffee shop. And actually, I think as the economy comes back, maintaining those customers is going to be a challenge for us. There is certainly a bit of luck involved in making sales projections. You see the $462 million in fiscal $450 million in fiscal 2006. That was the year that we had four drawings where the Powerball jackpot was in excess of $300 million, and we haven't seen that since. This year, baking that $517 million projection is going to be a stretch because we have, to date, had, I believe, seven Powerball drawings where the jackpot was $100 million or more. In an average year, we'll have 23 or more. That's random. It's nothing we can control, but it means that some years we will be higher than projections, some years we will be lower for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with our operations. Our contributions to the state last year also set a record at $122 million. Again, I wish we could guarantee a record every year. We can't. It's not that easy. The way that revenue is distributed, that our sales revenue, the biggest expenditure, of course, is prizes. If we don't offer prizes, people don't play. If we offer too much in prizes, we don't make any profits. We're trying very hard to find the appropriate level of balance on that. There are states that pay out more than we do. There are states that that pay out less. I think we're at a comfortable spot on that, but it's something that we're looking at all the time. Retailers earn 5.5 cents on every dollar they sell and earn an extra 0.5 cent for every dollar of prizes that they redeem for us. They can redeem up to $599. Ticket expense, basically that's what we have to pay the company who companies that print the tickets for us and the companies who distribute them to the stores, as well as the company that maintains the computers that spew out the Powerball tickets. And as sales go up, the dollar amount of that goes up, but the proportion stays the same. And then 5% of our revenue is spent on our administrative or operating budget, and that's what is reflected in the cap that you set in the appropriations bill. That leaves about one quarter of lottery revenues that go to the state beneficiaries. And that last year was distributed as follows. The general fund is the biggest recipient with a little over half the money that we turn over to the state going to the general fund. Another 2% of that going to the state's compulsive gambling program. That was $2.2 million last year. The Environmental Trust Fund received $31 million, or 26% of our total revenue, and then the remaining $11.7 million each through the in lieu of sales tax to the Natural Resources Fund and the Game and Fish Fund. Our operating expense, as you can see, we made major reductions in our operations during fiscal 03 and fiscal 04. Very substantial cut on our operating budget. We have remained relatively steady since that. Since then, yes, it has gone up. However, as you can see on the next slide, we've been able to keep that very steady as a percentage of our overall revenues. To some degree, of course, as sales go up, we're going to have some costs that will go up proportionally as well. But we're trying very, very hard to maintain this level of our operating costs as an overall percentage of revenue. There is, by the way, also in statute a cap on the percentage that we can spend on operations. However, I believe that's, what, 9%, I believe, Dale? Yeah. And so you can see that we're nowhere close to that limit. That's not a significant factor for us. These are our FTEs as of June 30th, basically the end of these fiscal years, so that might not exactly correspond to what you see in the budget packet. And again, we had a major cutback in staff in fiscal 03 and 04, and since then we've reduced slightly by attrition, but we anticipate staying at that roughly 140 level through the next biennium and beyond. The history of our operating cap, again, has remained relatively stable. The cap, you will notice, is greater than the amount that we budget for operations, and that's simply because, one, we certainly need some cushion, but particularly if an opportunity arises that we haven't been able to predict. More and more of our business is multi-state. In nature. Powerball, everyone knows, is a multi-state game, but we're looking at more and more opportunities where we have to cooperate with other states, such as a couple of years ago we offered a deal or no deal scratch game based on the TV show where we could offer people one of the prizes we could offer was the chance to go to Hollywood and essentially be on the show with Howie Mandel, and that's something we could not have done on our own. We had to work with other states. But also, as you can imagine, getting 44 state lotteries to agree on something is pretty difficult, and so we don't always know when that will happen. And if all of a sudden an opportunity presents itself, we need to be able to respond. We've been pretty good at maintaining our budget, operating budget, within what we have predicted, but having that flexibility is nice. I think we'll be requesting an operating cap of $29 million for fiscal 12 and fiscal 13. That's not the number that will be reflected in your budget spreadsheets. What will be reflected there is the amount that we project that we will spend, and is what is in the governor's budget package.
Mr. Feeney, these numbers that you have here, is that the 9% cap?
No, that is again very much lower than the 9% cap.
Mr. Okay. Chairman, these are the numbers that actually appeared in the appropriations bills for each biennium that sets the cap. Because every 2 years in the budget bill, there is a statutory cap, and these numbers reflect those numbers that have been passed in the last three or four biennials.
So we have your actual history, as we have in this review, that shows for projected 2011 operating expenses at $26,890,000. And correct. On that other one, you have a different number.
That's correct.
That's
yeah.
Higher, and then you've got the 9%. That's
yeah.
Higher yet,
Mr. Yeah. Chair. That is correct. The 9% is largely irrelevant. And what the cap that actually what would apply to us would be the lower of the two amounts. There will be a line in your appropriations bill that says the lottery may not expend more than blank. On operating costs during fiscal year 12 and fiscal year 13. That amount will be lower than the 9% that is referred to in statute, and that is what will govern the operations.
Okay, if you can finish up your presentation, sure. Then we have some other questions here.
These are the specific line items and the way that our money is spent, and you will find that also in the budget packet from in the governor's budget. As you can see, salaries are the largest percentage of our costs, followed by advertising, promotional expenses, and then a number of other items. I won't go into detail on those unless committee members would like to. But overall, I want to just focus on our record for over the last several years. Since fiscal 03, we've been able to increase our sales by 42%. Our revenues to the state have gone up more than that, at a 54% increase in 7 years. We did that with a reduction in operating cost of 20% and a reduction in staff of 31%. That is a record that I think shows that we have been pretty good stewards of the resources and the opportunities that have been given to us, and it's something that we look forward, it's a record that we look forward to continuing. It's not without its challenges. The retail environment is changing. We have lost a number of retailers because of economic conditions, and we're seeing more and more of retail sales overall going to national chains such as Target, Walmart, on the grocery side in particular, Aldi, a few others, which do not currently sell lottery products. And the reason they don't is because they are national chains. They do not want to be dealing with 44 different sets of state procedures and regulations. And again, this is something where we have to work in conjunction with the other 43 states that offer lotteries so that we can have a unified approach to working with these retailers. The economy, as I mentioned earlier, most lotteries around the country actually saw sales decline. We were one of the very few exceptions to that. But again, I think continuing maintaining that is going to be a challenge, particularly as gas prices go up. We do know lottery sales are sensitive to gas prices. Technology, there's this thing called called the Internet. Gambling is happening on the Internet. We know that our ability to directly work in that area is limited, but again, it's something I think that we have to be aware of. You know, one thing that I'll mention is that lottery tickets right now are basically a cash business. I think there are very good reasons for not allowing purchases on credit. However, we are also increasingly a cashless society. I think you all know people who never carry cash, making that adaptation is going to be a challenge for us. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I think we conclude our formal testimony. We'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Well, we have a number of members who have questions. Members, we have to be out of the room at 10 o'clock today. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. I just have two kind of questions. One just came with that. So it is a cash business, so you can't use any electronic form of payment. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, you can use debit cards. However, because it's very difficult to tell a debit card from a credit card, most retailers just will not accept any form of plastic.
So could you use your electronic EBT card that when you get the card that you use for public assistance benefits?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm not sure where they. I don't think it's allowed. Most retailers won't accept that either. But in some situations, from what my understanding, EBT cards are a cash, so that the person can then use it for any purpose that they want to. Kind of a substitution. Years ago, people got a welfare check or a check in the mail, and then cashed it, and then they used the cash for whatever.
Right, but at the point of, yeah. Mr. Chair, so at the point of, I guess it's a really good question because it comes up a lot around here. So I think what I'd like to know is at the point of sale, not if they go and turn it into cash and then buy it. I mean, I get that, but at the point of sale, is it permissible?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think it is, but that's not controlled by us. It's controlled by the I think the Department of Human Services that can that regulates.
Okay, that's good. I think that's a really good question to ask. That's kind of going on a lot around here, and I want to make sure that we're clear. Second thing, Mr. Chair, can we get a sense of where most of the where the bulk of the transactions come from? Do you do that geographically?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, we can actually we can track that down to any particular level you desire. Generally, what is lottery sales correlate extremely well with overall retail sales. They take place where the stores are. And a community that has large grocery stores will have much greater retail lottery sales than, particularly like Cub or Rainbow, than a community that does not. Likewise, if you're along a road that a lot of people use for commuting purposes and will stop for gas somewhere along there, their sales are going to be higher than somewhere that's a little more a little more off the beaten track. We do track the demographics of lottery players. The quick summary of that would be middle-aged, middle to upper income. Men and women are probably equally as likely to play. We know seniors play less, and we know people under the age of 35 play less. Beyond that, really not much in the way of significant differences.
Good. And then the last kind of statement, I guess what I would love to see if, when you guys come back or even if we have a chance, is the correlation between where the money is coming from, what communities they're coming out of versus the distribution. Hmm. There's been a lot of talk, at least some of my constituents, that think that the distribution of the proceeds beyond the general fund money, we get the bulk of it, but that they're going other places, and so the communities that spend the most money don't see the benefit of the lottery. So, and I know that's a long question, and you got a lot to do, Mr. Chair, but I think that that would be an interesting discussion when we have more time.
Representative Stansrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I'm just wondering numbers. If you'd I'm always looking at, you know, what kind of return on investment or gross profit margin in, mm-hmm. in private industry. I think I saw that on a bar chart or a graph. Is it about 24.5% is sort of your profit that goes to the state beneficiaries?
24 or 25, yeah.
All right. And just one follow-up.
Sure.
Is there an industry standard to say, how are we doing? Do we have as good a profit margin as we should? Or is there room for improvement? Or are we doing better than...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stansrud, there's always room for improvement, of course. Compared to, we like to compare ourselves to states about our size because there are tremendous economies of scale in this business, and we will never be able to operate as cheaply as an Illinois or a Texas. But compared to other states our size, yes, we are in the ballpark. The one qualification I'd make on that is people in Minnesota really like to buy scratch tickets. And scratch tickets have a lower profit margin than games like Powerball. In other states, people like to buy those games more, and their profit margin will be a little bit higher as a result. We wish it were the other way around, but people have this irritating habit of buying what they want rather than what we ask them to.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and back to a question that I started earlier. If we accept that Minnesota has a high per capita gambling rate, if we add more forms of gambling, are we then creating more gamblers or mostly the same people, which results in less gambling in other areas such as lottery or casinos or pull tabs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, I'm not convinced that gambling in Minnesota is really that much higher than it is in other states. To some degree, when it shows up that way, it's because we do a better job of keeping records than other states do. For example, for years we thought we had the number one charitable gambling industry in the country, and then Ohio actually started counting how much was going on there. All of a sudden, we were number two, and there are a number of other states like that who just basically aren't accounting for things very well. If you look at, for example, the number of gaming machines, slot machines per capita, we're a little bit on the high side, but it's not distributed that evenly. For example, the St. Louis metropolitan area, which is bit smaller than the Twin Cities metropolitan area, has considerably more gaming machines, slot machines, than the Twin Cities does. Kansas City, which is a lot smaller than Minneapolis-St. Paul, has about the same number of gaming machines. So I don't believe we are saturated. I don't believe this market is saturated. I believe that there is room for growth. Where that, you know, how much of that would be new revenue, how much of it would come, there would certainly be some substitution going on, no question. Not only substitution with other forms of gambling, but substitution with other goods and activities. And precisely how that would come about, I don't know. I don't think it's zero sum, but...
Representative Cox.
Chairman, I'm interested in that 225.
Representative Cox, would you push your...
Sorry. Time? I'm interested in that 225 appropriation to the for the North Central problem gambling. Is that in the governor's budget? I couldn't quite find it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cox, from what... I have not studied the governor's budget at great in great detail. I believe it is not.
Okay, and that usually, Mr. Chairman, that usually comes in from this committee then? Is that because it's not a continue, it's not part of the base budget, is that it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cox, you are correct.
Yes, okay. Then also, Mr. Chairman, do you give a list of the sites in order of their profitability? Or what is their what is your most profitable site? Let me stop by asking that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cox, in terms of our largest retail outlet in terms of sales by far is the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport.
Thank you.
Members, we're out of time for today, but thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And members, meeting adjourned.